This is XTP Media.
Hi, I'm Anthony Lindberg, Creative Director at Basic 6, and this episode is brought to you with the support of Basic 6. Basic 6 t-shirts are organic and ethically made. If you want a great t-shirt that shows that you know enough about aviation and aerospace by the designs they display, then get over to basic6.co.uk. Shipped anywhere in the world, you will get a 10% discount by using the promo code EXTENDED. You can only get this discount through this promotion, so wear the Aerospace to be seen in t-shirt. Go to basic6.co.uk. Enjoy the show.
Hi, I'm Mick Oakey. I'm the managing editor of The Aviation Historian, and this is Extended.
Hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello everyone, my name is Gareth Stringer, I'm the editor of Global Aviation Resource, and you are listening to episode 33 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. Joining me in the studio for today's episode, my good friends and fellow extended presenters, first of which, and the man usually in the hosting hot seat, is the one and only Peter Johnson from XTP Media. Peter, how are you?
I'm very good, Gareth. Thank you very much. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Good to be back in the studio and really excited about this programme.
Yeah, it's a cracker, I reckon. And it wouldn't be a cracker without Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson. Mr. Robinson, how are you?
Very well indeed.
Everything treating you well? How's the world of the Royal Aeronautical Society?
It's still there, still going well. Yeah, it's got a great show tonight. So see how we get on.
Excellent. And one of the reasons it's going to be an excellent show is that we have a returning guest with us for this episode. He is one of our favourites, and I mean that sincerely. He's an author, publisher, t-shirt designer, aerospace addict, and all-round good guy. He is, of course, Roland White. Roland, welcome back to Extended.
Good evening. Thanks very much indeed for having me. It's always a real treat to come on board.
Are you well?
Yeah, very well, thanks. I got some notes back from my publisher on the manuscript of the most recent book, so sort of once again feel like I'm kind of at the foot of the mountain, but that aside, all good, thank you.
We look forward to hearing how much of a climb you've got ahead of you when we speak in a few minutes, but thank you very, very much for coming back and joining us once again.
Thank you.
We've got a huge amount to get through tonight, as well as having Roland with us. We've got two exciting interviews, one of which is with Bill Ramsey about displaying the Vulcan this summer just gone, and also with John Lilly to talk about the People's Mosquito. So we'll bring those to you shortly. We've got all of our other regular segments. We've got a big stockpile of Get Involved feedback, which we have to thank all of you for sending that in. Tim has got a brand new X10, our top 10. I've got no idea what it is, so I'm looking forward to that. We've got a Pods Challenge from Amy. Again, I'm completely in the dark. Looking forward to that. We're going to wrap everything up with our promoting aerospace segment and a reminder of our aerospace awards. But as ever, let's get started and have a look at what's been in the aerospace news. Now, I'm going to start by going around all three of you in turn, if that's all right, and I've got one very, very simple question for you. At 9:24 a.m. Local time last Friday at Vandenberg Air Force Base in Southern California, the Boeing X-37B orbital test vehicle touched down after no less than 674 days in orbit. Peter, I'm going to start with you, and you've all got the same question. What was it doing?
Well, there's lots of speculation at the moment, of course, on what it's doing. But it was a military flight, so it has to have been doing something related to that. I think, personally, it was probably testing some equipment, but that equipment's probably related to some sort of spying exercise. So there's speculation about the Chinese space station and all sorts of things, but I think they're testing some new technology out. I think we'll find out in probably decades to come.
Roland, Peter's just mentioned the spying word. One, the conspiracy theory has it that it was gobbling up satellites, a la the spaceship in You Only Live Twice, if I have got my Bond reference correct. What do you reckon it might have been up to?
Well, I mean, we haven't been left much to speculate about it, because of China spying and Chinese satellites. But I can offer a sort of historical perspective, which might be of some interest, which is that in the course of the research I've been doing for the Shuttle book, a lot of these ideas, you know, spying on other satellites, even gobbling up or disabling enemy satellites, was discussed at great length and pursued quite seriously throughout the 60s. And the astronauts who I've been talking to, who were sort of crucial to the early years of the Shuttle program, came out of a military space program called the Manned Orbiting Laboratory. And for a while, but in the end, this idea was abandoned. For a while, one of the suggested uses for the Manned Orbiting Laboratory was to disable or knock out of orbit enemy satellites. So it's not a new idea. But I suspect that, what X-37's been doing is probably not completely unrelated to many of the things that that they were trying to do with Mole and its unmanned successors as well, both probably electronic intelligence gathering.
Okay. Tim has kindly volunteered to put his neck on the line for this evening's episode and tell us definitively, because he knows what he's talking about, what was going on. Tim, the United States Air Force will only say that it was conducting, and I quote, on orbit experiments. They are planning another launch for 2015, but joking aside, I guess we shouldn't really be holding our breath for any more information, should we?
No, I mean, it's one of the things that, those that do know, are going to say, and those that don't know are like ourselves are just kind of speculating. But it's a great thing for speculation. It's something that's obviously so highly classified that they can't even kind of give a hint out of apart from on orbit experiments, which is sort of pretty damn vague. One theory is that it might be doing something with extended
sort of
extended orbital maneuvering. One of the names was orbital maneuvering vehicle. And one of the ideas from a 2012 paper that was actually accessible online is it might be maneuvering using skipping off the Earth's atmosphere to prolong, change orbital planes, change orbits, and use the minimum of fuel. So that might be one idea why you want to keep it up for kind of 2 years is almost 2 years is, how long can you keep this, skipping over? Another one, and I'm leaning towards Roland's there, I think, of something to do with ELINT or maybe not disabling enemy satellites, but sort of tapping into them somehow, getting close enough to image them, something along those sort of things as to. It's something that they don't want to hint on, don't want to even hint, because the opposition or enemy nations will be able to take countermeasures, maybe some kind of simple countermeasure. So I'm pretty certain it's on some kind of 2 year spying mission, but what it is doing exactly, yeah.
On that experiment thing, on orbit experiments. I've just found a quote from Hank Hartsfield, who was one of those Mole astronauts and an early Shuttle pilot. He commented on the Manned Orbiting Laboratory being called a laboratory. And he said, you know, laboratory sounded, you know, wholesome enough. But Hank Hartsfield pointed out, even though it was called a laboratory, it was different kind of experiments that they were doing. And, you know, the candidate experiments included the neutralization of enemy satellites back in the mid 60s. So, on-orbit experiments could cover a multitude of different things.
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting one there with the neutralization or knocking out, is that you've got to be careful these days that, you know, I mean, any fool can get a small satellite, aim it into the path of another satellite and knock it out. But then you've got the problem of space debris. So, you know, taking that sort of line of thinking a bit further, you know, is it something that's designed to get close to another satellite, snip a few wires, bugger off, make a rapid escape, and do it without causing masses of space debris?
I think the avoidance of debris is key. I think it's going to far more likely to not be doing any physical damage. So, I mean, it's getting into the wild speculation, isn't it?
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with other satellites. You know, the orbital plane that it's been on suggests that it's, you know, covering the Middle East and Afghanistan. I mean,
yeah.
We really, really don't know. And as has already been said, you know, we can speculate, but we will not find out for decades, if indeed we find out at all. I mean, people with the sort of relevant security clearances still won't, in conversation, actually mention a KH-11 Kennan satellite. They'll just say, oh, it's still classified and I can't even talk to you about it.
Wow. Well, it is a brilliant subject for speculation. And I guess the fact that there's now quite a relatively long list of departments that at one stage or another have had responsibility for the X-37 only serves to increase that as well. I don't know whether that's just because of, you know, different roles for it, or whether they're learning about its capabilities as it goes. I don't know. But what a brilliant story. Peter, a little bit closer to home. Seems incredible, still talking about Malaysia Airlines Flight 370.
Yeah.
You know, we still don't know where this aircraft is. And the boss of Emirates, Tim Clark, has suggested, there's been a lot of chat about this, that aircraft, and this is a quote, must never be allowed to enter a non-trackable situation in the first place. And what they're actually talking about, and there is some support for this, I believe, is taking control for the transponders in an aircraft away from the flight deck.
Yeah, the story, of course, raged around Malaysian Flight 370, of course, and whether it is in the Southern Indian Ocean or not. But the key issue is that one of the transponder. And I thought long and hard about this, and I can't for the life of me understand this issue about control and whether it should be on the flight deck or not. Anyway, I think the reality is that I do agree with Tim Clark. It should be, all aircraft should be trackable. It's not like the pilots own them. You know, we've come on now in terms of, you know, the responsibilities of the captains and that sort of thing. And the reality is we can't ever allow something like this to happen again. So my view is, yes, we've got to make sure we can track these things. It's not spying the cabs. We've all got that, you know, wherever we live. You know, somebody's probably tracking me now on a Skype call. You know, we all have it in some form or other. Sign of the times. Cannot see another aircraft disappear like this and not be able to find it. It's outrageous.
Yeah. I'd like to put in the contrary opinion to that from the someone in the pilot community. Their argument is every electrical device on the plane must be able to be turned off, you know, for fire. You know, you must be able to turn this off and remove the electricity from it and switch the thing off, because, you know, if you can't switch it off, what happens then if it goes wrong and it catches fire? And there's another interesting reason for that as well, is that, you know, sometimes certain organizations might actually want an aircraft to disappear from ADS-B. We've had a situation where a Voyager air tanker from the RAF had its ADS-B on, you know, because it's supposed to fly through civil airlines, and it was flying over there to over Iraq to take up a tanker trail.
I totally get that, Tim. I really do, and I do also understand the issue about safety as well, and I think that there is technology now that can help us to identify those situations better, you know. And when we talk about trackable and non-trackable, of course, now we're also talking about service data for the aircraft being sent, you know, in real time. So the reality is that there's got to be a solution here, rather than, I suppose, the emotive one of which it seems to be of control, which seems to be very silly to be arguing about that when there's either a technological solution or not. And I think technology is there to help us. But of course, as you say, Gareth, we're still talking about an aircraft, a 777 that's sitting somewhere on this planet, and we don't actually know where. So very sad.
Totally, totally. And without at all making light of the situation, your assertion that this call is probably being tracked, I think, bearing in mind Tim's just gone on to connect the X-37B with extended, I think that's probably no question about it. So if you're listening in Langley, Virginia, welcome to the show. Moving on to something a little bit different. I don't know how many T-shirts you've sold, Roland, but Britain has apparently overtaken Germany as the billionaire capital of Europe. And a spin-off from that is that there's been more what they call large cabin heavy jets. These are a large private jets delivered to the UK and anywhere else, 65 of them between 2009 and last year, bringing the number registered in the UK up to nearly 400. I don't know what I'm more surprised about, Roland, the fact that we're the billionaire capital of Europe or the fact that there's 400 of these incredibly expensive private jets registered in the UK.
Well, I think I think it's London is the billionaire capital of Europe. I would have thought, you know, not, I wouldn't imagine the rest of the country gets a look in. But there's certainly, on the strength of the T-shirt sales, no good reason for addressing the question to me either. I think the idea of kind of these big cabin executive jets is a seductive one, and I've got a friend actually who's a photographer who has done quite a lot of work recording some of the interiors that have been put together for the sort of super rich clients, which you know, sadly, because of the sort of confidentiality and things, he's not been able to show me, but he's sort of described in you know, incredibly vivid terms, and you know, the opulence is just extraordinary, and also the space available is so incredible too. But I mean, without actually kind of getting to see them, I suppose I'm sort of tempted to sort of segue right into the next segment and say that if T-shirt sales picked up and I were in the market for my own executive jet, I suspect that I'd be knocking on the door of Mitsubishi pretty soon, because I think that this new MRJ that they have rolled out this week is an unbelievably good-looking thing.
Yeah, we've also seen that Gulfstream are launching two new models as well. So the sector that seemed to be judged very heavily in the recession that started, 5 or 6 years ago, seems to be coming back. I just wanted to ask Tim, actually. Tim, with the changes to the registration legislation, you know, we've got the Isle of Man, we've got the Channel Islands, we're seeing a lot of aircraft go there. Are they picked up as UK, or are they recorded separately? Because if they're recorded separately, the number's probably bigger.
It's an interesting one as to where they got the figures from. You know, it's a separate registration, obviously. Isle of Man, so I wonder whether it would that could possibly include Isle of Man as well. So I mean, you know, it'd be one to look into. That was
we certainly hope that our previous guests from Connect Jets can sell an Avanti Evo or two. I want to see a few more of those in the UK. Love them.
And I have to say, Roland, as well, these two new Gulfstreams, the G500 and G600. I'm just reading about some of the technology that's included. And I have to say, apart from a couple of things, but fly-by-wire, active control side sticks, auto brake, auto throttles, emergency descent mode, and avionics. It sounds a little bit like the space shuttle.
Well, it does. Not the only connection between the Gulfstream and the space shuttle. I mean, the G2 was used as a shuttle training aircraft from right at the beginning of the program. I think the first one was operational in 1976, and they did all sorts of beefing up of the airframe. They cleared it to reverse thrust in a steep descent. With the wheels down, and mimic the very steep low drag and sort of steep descent of low lift, high drag descent of the shuttle. It was used right through until the retirement of the shuttle. But from what I understand, talking to some of the astronauts, you know, when the simulation took over, looking out of the cockpit windows, you were just sort of staring at the ground. I mean, it's like flying a dive bomber. But then the G2 got the nod after they tried. They looked at a 737, first of all, and also considered the possibility of using an A6 Intruder as well, but the 737 was too expensive. The A6 Intruder, despite having side-by-side seating and obviously being tough as a tank, did feel like a space shuttle. So the G2 got the nod, the Gulfstream got the nod. But that was the first part of the shuttle program which went over budget, was the Gulfstream shuttle training aircraft program, which was done converted by Grumman.
Wow. That's fascinating stuff. We're going to finish the news in space, and it's just a quick one, Peter, isn't it? We need to give ESA a pat on the back for a fifth launch for Ariane 5 this calendar year.
Yeah, that's right, and should be doing this in promoting aerospace, really. But fifth launch this year of the Ariane 5. They've also Ariane Space have also launched three Soyuz and a Vega, and they're looking to target 12 missions for the year. But just to put into context, Ariane 5 and Ariane Space and how well they're doing, 220th launch of an Ariane vehicle, 62nd consecutive successful Ariane 5 launch, and that's the 76th flight of an Ariane 5 that left terra firma a few days ago. So fantastic record, and just goes to show that although the talk at the moment is all about what's happening stateside, ESA are gently going on their way.
No, I think that's you're very well put, and they're obviously delivering. I mean, two telecom satellites delivered from this most recent launch. I dread to think what they must be and what the insurance implications are of something,
I would imagine their insurance bill has been going down recently with the successes. And I suppose the great thing is that on the horizon, one of the flights later this year will be the experimental vehicle, the 1XV space plane. I think that's early December, Tim, if I remember rightly. So exciting times for the European Space Agency, of course, which the UK Space Agency is a very large part.
Absolutely, and we'll keep an eye on that. That's it for the news.
Definitely.
In episode 33. We'll be back in a minute, and we're going to be talking to Roland.
14.05, there is an issue on the aerodrome at the moment. Go around, maintain runway heading, climb 4,000.
Going round, maintain runway heading, climb 4,000, roster 14.05.
It's been made, you can expect holding. I'll advise when I have further information. 4245, maintain 3,000.
Here, flapping for 3,000, think about the 45.
8845.
11845, roster 14.05.
37.
Killing 769 Delta, maintain 6,000.
6,000, Killing 769 Delta, okay, for reduced to mid speed.
8 Sam, yeah, I'll find what's going on in a sec.
Singapore.
Everyone can have speed as they like. Again, break Singapore 245. Turn left heading 190, just positioning towards the field to keep your number one. I'll update you shortly.
Okay, left heading 190, Singapore 245.
Brisbane departure, crossing 14.05. We're maintaining runway heading on time 4,000.
RC 1405. G'day, this stage maintain runway track. I've just got to get you in a position.
Maintain runway track, RC 1405.
Singapore 245. Continue the left turn, heading 160. And intercept the localizer for runway 19, climb to 4000. You can expect to hold inbound on the localizer shortly.
Okay, to climb to 4000 feet and to intercept the localizer, runway 19, Singapore 245.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about the Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
Oi, we know you're in there!
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, the Aviation Historian.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
TheVoicesInYourHead.com.
Roland, we've mentioned the shuttle inevitably, I think, almost a couple of times already. This book project, you told us before we came on air that you're starting the process of finishing it. That's not a freewheel downhill, though, is it? It's definitely a climb to the ascent, by the sounds of it.
I mean, it's true. I mean, I delivered the manuscript a few months back and shared that first draft with Bob Crippen and Dick Truley, who were the pilots on the first and second space shuttle missions, respectively, and with my editor at Bantam. So I've got notes back from all three of them, I'm incredibly grateful to Bob Crippen and Dick Truley for correcting some of my more foolish mistakes, and also to my editor for pointing out that we really needed to get into the story a little bit more quickly. But I think that the difficulty with this one has been that, you know, obviously with Vulcan 607 we're telling a story that spanned about a month. With the subsequent books, that time frame got a little bit longer. But with the shuttle, if you look at the story from the moment that it was first authorized by President Nixon, it's a decade-long story. And if you look at the experience of the astronauts, and I'm very keen to try and tell two stories in parallel. One is of the development of American spy satellites, but also of the shuttle. Then you're looking at a story which starts back in the early 60s and the time that people like Bob and Dick went through Chuck Yeager's aerospace research pilot school at Edwards Air Force Base, flying F-104s on Zoom climbs to 80,000 feet and then disappearing into the black world of that manned orbiting laboratory, which just some details of which is just starting to be declassified now, which was cancelled in 1969 in favor of unmanned spy satellites. But those two strands of the story, you know, I'm happy to say, do converge again in the story of STS-1, the first space shuttle flight. So I'm just doing some work on the first third of the book, just to establish the characters and get, I think, sort of strip back some sort of extraneous detail, which I sort of found fascinating researching, but is a little too much. Before the story then, you know, sort of kicks off halfway through with Enterprise flights off the back of 747, and then obviously the launch of the shuttle itself in April 1981. But I mean, it feels to me, and I hope readers ultimately will agree, that story of the space shuttle flight has all the sort of the pace and the thriller-like feel that the sort of climax of Vulcan 607 or Phoenix Squadron had. Certainly, that's my intention, and it's been great fun trying to put it together.
I think it comes across very clearly in your writing, if you don't mind me saying this, that as well as the history and the aviation and the technology, you know, there is almost a sort of boy's own element to these stories. And, you know, we've mentioned that word a few times already in the last couple of minutes. You know, the story is obviously key to you. It's got to have that narrative and that thriller element. And it's funny, it just strikes me that, you know, we've been talking about the X-37, and even though you've just been talking about some projects which were happening 40, 50 years ago, the X-37's actually got all of that as well, hasn't it? And that I think is the thing that makes it that appealing, because we don't know what it's doing, and and it's spying and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, spying, obviously gets the heart beating a little faster, but so too does the mention of a space plane. I mean, you know, so you've only got to mention space plane and you've got my attention. And the story of the shuttle, you know, going back to things like the X-20 Dinosaur, which the USAF were pursuing before it was cancelled in favour of the manned orbiting laboratory, was an amazing thing. The other X-plane, or rather other space plane story at the moment, which sort of captured my imagination, is the Dream Chaser project, which obviously kind of recently just lost out to sort of Boeing and to Elon Musk as NASA's sort of favored crew vehicles. It was the Dream Chaser that was the one which was most interesting to me, because it was had sort of wings after a fashion, came back to land on a runway just like a machine out of a sort of Gerry Anderson series. You mentioned, you know, that my interest is, it's a kind of boy's own interest, and you know, hopefully in kind of identifying the elements of what can sometimes be kind of quite an arcane and technical story that have that sort of boy's own appeal. We can grab readers and also kind of less geeky readers than me as well, you know, sort of appeal to the broadest possible readership who are just looking for a good page-turning story.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully we can sort of slip in a few sort of technical details and things, you know, along the way, and I work hard to try to bring those to life or convey them in a way that isn't just incredibly boring.
Just on that question, on that sort of theme, Roland, of kind of appealing to kind of more people outside the the Av Geek universe. I mean, one of the things about Vulcan 607 is a massive breakout hit for non-aviation enthusiasts to kind of pick up. But have you got have you already identified things that you will think, these are such cool things I've found out in this book that is going to be a talking point it's going to make the news somehow, some kind of revelation that'll kind of catch.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I do try to. I mean, I think I mentioned earlier some of the difficulties there are with this particular subject in terms of getting people to talk about it. You won't find anybody with the security clearances for the talent keyhole security clearances who inside the spy satellite program referring to the KH-11 satellite by name. And yet, if you look through the indexes of the declassified program histories on the CIA's website, you'll see that they go KH-4, KH-5, KH-6, KH-7, and then there's a gap, and you would imagine that KH-8's in there, but you'd imagine that the gaps would follow the numbers that follow, 9, 8, 9, and they'd be 10 and 11. So often it's what's missing and how kind of specifically it's missing that can provide the clues to the existence of the things that you're looking for. But one of the things I've tried to do in this is just piece together information from lots and lots of different sources in the hope of demonstrating a really convincing circumstantial case for what
what I know happened during that first space shuttle mission. And then just tried to establish from people who know the story a great deal better than me whether or not maintaining that this was what happened was going to be something that might lead to me getting egg on my face. And I don't believe that that's the case. And I think if you look through the mission transcripts from STS-1, the occasions where it looks where it has been reported by people who spend a lot of time looking at the orbits of spy satellites and the space shuttle, that the spy satellites and the shuttle might have come together during that first mission, conform completely to the points in the mission transcripts, which come from NASA, with the points in mission transcripts that identify the timings and the directions of the sort of on-orbit maneuvers that would dictate which way the shuttle was facing, i.e., in the direction of something that might be taking a photograph of it. So it's often been quite sort of, I realize I'm sort of going on and on and on about this, but it's often quite sort of forensic work comparing one document with another that can reveal the strength of one's position.
Roland, I don't know what the rules in the US are about information being declassified, or whether there's sort of, there's any concrete rules there. But shuttle astronaut Mike Mullane, who you'll remember, we were honoured to have as a guest interviewee for Extended. I think in his second or third shuttle mission, he tells the story of Rhino rockets, that mission was a military mission. It was to deploy a satellite, I think that's probably about as much as he says, into orbit. And he was actually, the crew were awarded a medal for that mission, for the successful deployment of that payload. And that's a medal that he'll never be able to show, so I don't think, his wife or his kids. And I think they told him he could go and visit the medal if he wanted to, but it wouldn't kind of leave the building. But did the shuttle do as much of that as maybe, or more maybe, than people think? Did they actually get a lot of sort of deal contracts, as it were, from the military to go and put things into orbit that we don't know what they are?
No, there were plenty of military missions, military payloads. I mean, it never worked out entirely as expected. And actually, Bob Crippen was training for an exclusively military mission, the first, which was going to be launched out of Vandenberg in 1986, when they were working with the payload in New Mexico, when they watched the Challenger disaster unfold. And Bob's view is that had that particular mission gone ahead out of Vandenberg, and Vandenberg was crucial because it was the only launch site in North America from which you can launch satellites without flying over either other people's countries or your own built up areas into a polar orbit, which is the orbit you want your spy satellites to be in. He says if that mission had gone ahead, and on board was going to be Undersecretary of the Air Force Pete Aldridge, and the Undersecretary of the Air Force is also the role which has as part of it head of the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, that mission gone ahead with Pete Aldridge on board, he would have realized the value of the shuttle and would have become a committed supporter of it and what it might offer the military and the NRO particularly. And that then Vandenberg would have come on stream as essentially a military shuttle launch site. That never happened as a result of Challenger. And as a result, none of those big KH-11 satellites were, as far as I know, ever launched on board the shuttle. But a radar reconnaissance satellite, which was codenamed La Crosse, was launched out of the shuttle. But not into, and it was the high, it was a Mike Mullane's mission. It was the highest inclination orbit ever launched out of Kennedy, carried this La Crosse satellite.
Okay. Just in practical terms then, this sort of final push to finish the project, what happens next? Do you know when we're going to see it? Can you tell us what it's going to be called, or is that currently classified information?
It's currently, no, it's not. It's going to be called Into the Black. the subtitle will be something, I think, along the lines of the untold story of the first space shuttle mission.
Wow.
Or the first flight of the space shuttle. I'm hoping to get a finished manuscript done by this side of Christmas, so I'm hoping we might have something copy-edited and typeset early next year. I'll be then sharing it as widely as possible, proofs of that as widely as possible, certainly with you three gentlemen, and as many writers, astronauts, scientists who... I believe sort of might have an interest as I possibly can to try and get some early endorsements of the book. I think the publication date is still something of a movable feast. I'm hoping we might see it next year, but it could be that it ends up being really early 2016, just because the last third of the year is often completely dominated by celebrity autobiographies and things, and a book about space shuttle may not get a look in that company.
Listen, that's fantastic. I mean, I think the other thing that strikes me, and I'm sure Tim and Peter, about the amount of work and time you put into this project, and I'm sure your previous projects. I mean, it must be quite exciting for you to get towards the end, but equally, that there's got to be a sigh of relief at some point, hasn't there?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, and the sigh of relief from me is nothing compared to the cheering that you'll get from my wife when finally I can start to take some interest in the children and the state of the house and all the other things which I have sort of reneged on over the last kind of couple of years. She's been fantastic, and you put it very well at the beginning, Tim. We're sort of at the beginning of the end, I think it's going to be a few more weeks, and I'll be in the clear. But it's a really exciting prospect, being so close to a book which as you said has been a long time, a lot of work, but has really started to sort of crystallise, and that's an exciting prospect. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure I speak for everybody to say we can't wait to see it, and wish you all the best with that last push. But it's not all you've been doing, is it? The t-shirts, which I think we'll love. There's some more of those coming, isn't there? We will see those before Christmas, won't we?
No, it sort of got slightly overtaken by the sort of last push on the shuttle book. There's only so many hours in the day, but I have just briefed another 10 or 15 designs to the chap I'm kind of working with on these, and so I'm hoping that they will sort of get done between now and Christmas, and that we'll be able to sort of launch them onto an unwilling and unsuspecting world in the new year. But I mean, there's some ideas that I love in there. We'll certainly be looking at a fictional mission patch for David Bowie's Major Tom and his tin can space capsule. So there's some fun things in that vein, and a few more of those, and pilot's notes t-shirts as well, with sort of equally wild and wonderful machines on there, including I think possibly Harry Potter's Ford Anglia.
Fantastic.
I think I'm just about skirt around the it's just copyright and trademark issues that the J.K. Rowling machine might be able to come up with, but we'll see. Now, if I'm languishing in jail this time next year, it'll probably be because of that. That's been fun, and definitely more on the way on that front.
Okay, finally, we can't ignore this, because I'm incredibly excited about this. On my little aviation library next to me, up there in the corner, not too far from Vulcan 607, actually, I can see a book called F4 Phantom, with the name Robert Priest written on the spine of the book. And this is a book which I think a lot of our listeners, and I certainly know Tim and maybe Peter, are very, very familiar with. This was when I was a kid. The book came out, I think, in 1979, off the top of my head. This was the first time I'd really read any stories about anybody who was a fast jet pilot. And you can find the book if you look really, really hard these days, but suffice to say, it's not in print. But Roland, you might potentially be going to try something about that.
Well, I mean,
You know, I feel exactly the same way as you about F4 Phantom, you know, along with sort of things like, you know, Jan Marks, Thunder and Lightning.
Oh, another classic.
Yeah, I mean, exactly, you know, that provokes that sort of response. I mean, F4 Phantom, I felt when I came across it growing up, it was a book that was sort of written for me. It's, you know, fantastic, vivid, beautifully written account of life as a Phantom pilot in the 70s. I discovered that he was good friends, Bob Prest, with Martin Withers, who, of course, flew Falcon 607, and they'd been instructors together. And sort of through one connection or another, I managed to sort of track down Bob to the Middle East, where he's flying as a, I think, 777 captain for Qatar Airways. Raised the idea of getting F4 Phantom back in print, both possibly as a physical edition, certainly as an ebook, and he's all for the idea. I'm looking at making that happen. I think early next year, along with a handful of other books which are out of print and that have been, you know, favourites of mine, you know, over the years. So, you know, I'm sort of going over my my shelves and looking for those you know, lost gems that you know, I hope or sort of feel really deserve an audience today. And you know, I hope if I can sort of just, you know, curate and make available a selection of some of the better ones, and you know, I'll be doing, you know, everyone a favour, not least the authors, or in some cases their you know, their sons and daughters. You know, I think very little gets forgotten now in this sort of ebook world. You know, once the book's published, it's sort of published forever. But you know, that really only developed in the last 5 years or so. If a really good aviation book came and went out of print at any time prior to that, you know, it's likely that only you know, somebody who loved it once will know about it. And unless they're, you know, they have sort of interest in publishing and books, it's perhaps unlikely that they're going to be in a position to sort of bring it to life again. So hopefully we'll see you know, a handful of a few lost classics getting read and enjoyed again.
I have to say, you
know, F4 fans at the top of the list.
Yep.
Utterly amazing news, I think.
Yeah, and, great. Well, like, done, Roland.
Genuinely, I think it's fantastic. Not just the fact that it's that book, but that concept that you've just described, I think, is brilliant. And that would be a brilliant use of technology and all those things, I think, to try and make those, you know, some of these titles available,
yeah,
to a new audience. And you know, you'll know as well as we do, I think, that, you know, you can still, and I still do, I read it probably on an annual basis.
Yeah.
I dread to think how many times I've picked that book up, but it's as fresh and as wonderful reading it every single time I pick it up, and it's up there with Richard Bach and people like that, as far as I'm concerned. It's brilliant.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, I can't walk past a copy in a secondhand bookshop without sort of buying it. I've got sort of two or three.
So that's where they all are.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, it might be easier to print some new ones rather than just keep on buying the ones that are out there.
Roland, that's all fantastic, brilliant stuff. It's great to catch up and see where,
yeah,
you're at.
Thank you.
I know that our two interviews that are coming up are probably right up your street as well, Vulcan and Mosquito. So before this turns into the most epic, and I mean in terms of length, podcast of all time, let's move on to those. I think, Peter, we're going to start with John Lilly from The People's Mosquito, which was an interview that you carried out.
Yeah, John Lilly's the chairman of The People's Mosquito, and he joined me all the way from China to tell us a little bit about the latest developments in getting a mosquito back to flight in the UK.
John, welcome to Extended.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
You're on the other side of the world at the moment. You're calling us from China, so we really appreciate your time. The last time we spoke to Bill Ramsey back in the early part of 2012 about the project, it really was in its infancy then. Can you just remind everyone what the People's Mosquito is and why you chose that description?
Yeah, the People's Mosquito is to resurrect probably one of the greatest aircraft the British which is Britain's ever invented, really, to the UK skies. It's very much a missed aeroplane on the aviation historic scene. And you know, not only was it a superb design, it was also a story that really embodies what's best of British, really.
Yeah.
Ingenuity of design, going against the grain, pardon the pun, really, I guess would be the main topic in this. You know, absolute British determination and maybe people say stubbornness, and also entrepreneurship as well. And also, you know, when, you know, our great nation's backs against the wall, it's tend to when we do our best, you know, the best spirit of Britain comes out.
Yeah.
You know, for me, you know, and a lot of other warbird or aviation enthusiasts, the aeroplane is widely missed since the demise, sad demise of Rolls-Royce's RR-299 many, many years ago. And I think it's the most missed warbird or aeroplane on the aviation scene voted by the public. So the motivation really came around, you know, to bring something back and understanding that the technology had been rediscovered. You know, that'd been long thought, lost and forgotten,
was
bonus. And then I was reflecting several Christmases ago about how the model of the Vulcan to the Sky project had been a fantastic success, you know, which is where, you know, the connection with Bill comes in. And the fact is, you know, they've had their ups and downs as a project has been widely publicised, but you have to take your hats off to the whole team and say, look what they achieved. But not only that, you know, she's called the Spirit of Great Britain, isn't she?
Yeah.
And the whole public's got its imagination and it's, more importantly, they've parted with their own hard-earned cash to resurrect a fantastic aeroplane. And really, people are proud of it. And we want to do the same with the Mosquito.
Right, okay.
So that's where the motivation came from. And the reason why it's called the People's Mosquito is for several reasons. It's because if you look back at the history of the construction of the aeroplane, it was really not just de Havilland's. There was a whole cottage industry behind the production of the airplane from, I think, little old ladies and guys who were retired in post offices making Bakelite bits, I believe, or some sort of sewing kits, through to furniture makers, cabinet makers, and other industries that were turned to, put into the war effort. But World War II has been widely recognised by many historians as a true people's war. It was a global war, obviously, which embodied not just troops at the front line, it affected everybody, you know, from the Blitz, you know, massively, didn't it? And it was a massive part of what shaped Britain today, 70, 75 years later. So that's where we get our motto, you know, sort of to fly, you know, to educate and to restore and to remember.
Of course, and that's a critical part is to keep that alive for the generations to come as well. You found an airframe. You've got an airframe now. Can you tell us a little bit about what state it's in and why you chose this airframe as the restoration project?
Okay, good. First of all, let's deal with the state it's in. It's probably in it's in a very, very sorry state, as in not much left in it at all. It could probably fill a transit van, really, with bits and pieces and stuff. So, yeah, a very sorry state. RL-249 crashed on a twin engine failure takeoff in 1947 from an RAF base in Norfolk. And RAF culture shop. And she made a successful belly landing. The pilots got out and stuff. But she was deemed a write-off and subsequently parked up on the peritrack near their area using an instructional airframe after being robbed of the usual bits for spares for other aeroplanes. And then when the runway was extended for jets coming into the RAF service, they pulled the boundaries in of the airfield and she was unceremoniously set on fire and big hole dug and dumped in the hole. So that shows you how much is not left.
Yeah,
there you go. Not great.
I mean, it's just I know there were a plethora of airframes around at that time, but it just seems so heartbreaking to see aircraft dealt with that way.
It does. It does. I mean, there are many stories of, you know, planes are, you know, in crates in Burma to down coal shaft mines and things like that. But she was found and located in 2010, you know, through a local enthusiast, you know, who also specialised in finding buried aeroplanes amongst other things as well.
Yeah.
So we were able to find the remains, and he kindly donated the remains to the People's Mosquito, and we've acquired them now ourselves. The reason why we chose that airframe is because there is very little around in the world to acquire. If you go on Mozzie.org or Mozzie.org on the internet, a great website run by Andy Dawson, who's an absolute mosquito aficionado as well, he will list all the mosquitoes that are extant. And there's a lot of museums where museums won't part with them.
Yeah.
You know, quite understandably. And, you know, what airframes are left, there's very little of, like ours. And, you know, some of those have been restored, like Jerry Yeagan's FB6, KA-114. And, you know, the other ones are very much, again, some, you know, questions around sort of, you know, how much they're worth in terms of value and what's left, etc. So, believe you me, we have tried to acquire every airframe that was available or look at how we can do that.
Yeah.
And we were either not satisfied under due diligence, or they just weren't simply not available. Or quite simply, they were out of our financial reach.
Right.
There's the three reasons why.
Yeah.
And when you talk to the CAA, the CAA will tell you, fantastic, we love mosquitoes. What's your plan? What's your engineering plan? So you talk about your engineering plan, and they say, thank you very much that you're doing brand new wood. The CAA are very, nervous about flying very old wood that's been sat in a museum for 50, 60 years, and may have delaminated. In fact, they have lots of data on metallurgy, but there is very little stroke zero data on old wood. On old wooden airplanes of that type. You know, I know that you can talk about tiger moths and other things, you know, bits and pieces. But, you know, there are frames in there and it's more canvas and doping and other things. Yes, and there's wood as well in that. But not a mosquito, not such an advanced type as this. So whatever aircraft you acquire, whatever state and or volume of original parts you have left, you're looking at doing new wood because of safety.
Yeah.
That's the number one reason.
So John, is in terms of parts and bringing this together, this is a massive undertaking. You know, I've seen the photos of what's left of her, and it would appear that you're going to have to re-engineer a great deal more than just the wood. That's a massive undertaking. How long is this going to take? And I suppose the ultimate question is, what's it going to cost?
We have a five-year business plan, and it can be achieved within 5 years. Is the bottom line. However, just think of this as a piece of elastic that can stretch.
Yeah.
Because that five-year plan is determined about funding coming in. So funding coming in, you know, we will need. We're looking at a budget of just over, you know, £5 million.
Okay.
To put this into the air and run the. With the testing, the shipping, everything else. And we have a very clear business plan and budget to do that, and a very clear plan, which you can find on our website.
Yeah.
You know, so, but that five-year plan could become 6, 7, or 8, again, depending on how people, you know, take to our project and willing to back us and get behind us.
And what sort of support are you getting, John?
Good support. I think we're definitely... this year we started sort of like fundraising very slowly and deliberately slowly in April of this year, because we are all volunteers doing this. We all have a day job.
Yeah.
Hence I'm in China working for a very large organization on the other side of the world. So I'm doing this in my spare time in my evening at the moment, talking to you.
Yeah.
And all my colleagues are doing this spare time. People's Mosquito has set itself up as an incorporated charitable company. We're a charity now, but we're going through the process of becoming a registered charity with the Charities Commission. We've got a great patron on board, which we'll come to later at the end. And we've been getting out there to air shows like Sywell, especially on the Three Lengths tour as well. We've been very visible at places like East Kirby.
Yeah.
We've also been present at Duxford for one shot, the September air show. And we've had phenomenal response. Incredible. Not one person has come through the tent and said, oh, what a bad idea. What terrible project.
Yeah.
They've all come through and gone, wow, good for you. Great. Let's help you.
But it wasn't always like that, was it? I seem to remember in the early days, people were saying, you know, on social media, what are you doing this for? Is it possible? Is it feasible? You guys have come a massively long way in the last 2 years, a five-year plan. You know what you need. You know what you need to do. Quite some undertaking, but a fantastic initiative that you've now got in place. John, can I ask you a little bit about some of the technical questions of the aircraft? I have to ask it. What Merlin engine are you going to use?
Oh, we're going to go 60 series.
Yep.
But we're not going to use the second stage supercharger. You're probably crying at that idea. quite simply, the CA will not let me operate above 8,700 feet. So therefore there's no need for that extra power and wear on the engine, which is good. It keeps wear and tear down. The other reason for using 60 series is that we can go with Dakota hub and props, which is very, very similar in design to the original Diavolin blades on there. And the good news about that means spares. And with the 60 series engine as well, you know, they are tend to be a bit of a later engine, and therefore there's a lot of those engines around in the Warbirds since, therefore, spares is available. RL249 was originally an NF36, but they used the more exotic Merlin 113, 114 engines, of which there was only, I think, 230-odd made. Somebody may correct me on the show or later on. The point is, there are thousands of Merlin 60 series.
Yeah, okay.
6.6 or whatever you go with. You know, and yes, if you can ask me the next question, we do know how much they cost. We do know where potentially we would like that contract to lie.
Yeah.
And we're constantly evaluating the cost of provision of engines and hubs, but we know what we're going to run.
Okay.
Also, being under 10,000 feet, just to be more technical, we don't need oxygen. So therefore, we're able to save some weight on the aeroplane as well, and which is pretty good.
Yeah, okay.
So, 670-ish horsepower engines. So is that fast enough?
Oh, I just can't wait, John. I just can't wait not only to see her, but to hear her as well. Now, you talked about people getting involved. Before we get on to that, where are you going to base the aircraft? How are you going to operate it?
Well, that's interesting because we've had a number of inquiries and a number of conversations. We haven't yet determined a final resting home, but we want it to be a home of some historical significance.
Right, okay.
That doesn't mean Duxford is somebody who'll probably come to strain to people's minds listening to the show. That doesn't necessarily mean Duxford. Of course not. But we've had some very interesting conversations with, you know, historic aviation centres throughout the UK.
Right.
All I can say at this stage is it will be somewhere where people can have a great experience.
Yeah. Okay, and what is the plan for the aircraft? I mean, we want to see it fly, of course, but are you also planning to use it when it's not flying as a historical item for people to visit and see and interact with?
Absolutely, 100%. Because what I want to do as we get more and more money through the door, get more and more construction going, is get a lot of access through live streaming webcams and things like this.
Yeah.
Talking to the manufacturers, especially a company called Aerowood in New Zealand, who are fantastic, by the way. They've got a great Facebook page.
Yeah.
Recommend it. They're regularly updating how they're making the wings at the moment. And, you know, we want people to see and understand. Remember, one of our mottos is to educate. But we want people to feel involved, answer the people's mosquito. And, yes, we want this to be a touchy-feely aeroplane. Yeah, you know what? There's a lot of people get a bit stuffy about public being aeroplanes and stuff. But what I found, and I've done many, many, many things at Duxford as a volunteer myself, 99.9% of the public, if you give them instruction, and you guide them in the right direction. You tell them what's not to touch, what is okay to touch. They just love it. They respect it. They get into it. You know, if you look at how many people clamber aboard Sally B when she opens the doors, you know, when people go up to the Vulcan, et cetera, et cetera, the answer is yes. We want this to be the people's aeroplane. And in fact, what we want to do in terms of a flying program, when we come to plan that, is a little bit like the BBMF do. You know, if you've got an event, you know, not necessarily you're going to have an air show, but let's say, can you fly over our memorial at such a time?
Yeah.
We will look at if that's possible on the flight plan. So, again, we want this, you know, the plane to be seen and recognised as the people's mosquito.
Right, okay. And you have a new patron. You made the announcement within the last week, probably Britain's greatest pilot. Can you tell us about your new patron?
Yeah, I mean, Captain Eric Winkle Brown needs no introduction by anybody, does he really?
No. Certainly we've not. Had him on the show and he is just, you know, you have to worship the ground he walks on, really.
Absolutely. Well, I hope if I ever see 95, I've got his mind and memory.
Yes.
Fabulous. I was only speaking to him last week, and he was telling me about the German technology at the end of World War II as if it was yesterday.
Yeah.
But, of course, he has an affection for the mosquito. And as soon as we were able to talk to him and meet with him, he was absolutely he was like a kid in a sweet shop again. And, you know, he talks about the mosquito. He thinks it's Britain's most important aeroplane of World War II. You know, recognise that we do. He said, yes, of course, the Spitfire. Yes, of course, the Hurricane. There are many great types, the Lancaster. You know, there's many great types. The Stirling, the Halifaxes all did stupendous jobs in the war. But he sort of said, you know, Mosquito was a bit of a game changer, a bit like the Spitfire was, a bit like the Lancaster was. And, you know, he agrees with us that it really was the world's first multi-role combat aeroplane. And, you know, I mean, how he actually landed a Mosquito on a rolling sea deck around about 40 miles an hour below its stalling speed, I will never understand.
He certainly has some stories, and his books are fantastic. We've talked about some people involved in the project, but the real people are, of course, the public out there. How can they get involved? How can they support the project? And how can we follow you online?
Basically, we're on Twitter at People's Mosquito. We have a Facebook page, the People's Mosquito, as you do. And on our website as well, which is www.peoplesmosquito.org.uk. You've got lots of links there, our business plan, more importantly, fundraising.
Yeah.
You can donate through the webpage. We also have an online shop where we've got some very nice, attractive T-shirts, baseball caps, mugs, umbrellas, you name it as well. You can do this. And we've also got a link to Easy Giving. So we've got this Easy Giving portal to enable people to donate through that way, or as well as through PayPal. But again, we've gone with the Easy Giving, so you know, not everybody uses PayPal, so we've got something else set up as well through that. Really, what we need at the moment, we've got lots. I can't believe how many people have come forward offering their time and energy, from engineers to pilots to whatever. We will be organising next year a bigger presence at air shows. So, and I'd like to organise some volunteers around regionally, so maybe North East or London or, you know, the South Coast, etc. So if anybody out there wants to get involved in, you know, coming on our stand, volunteering their time and help us, you know, convince people that our project is brilliant and part of our hard-earned cash, then I'd like to hear from you. Similarly, it's, you know, the Warbird business is a cash business. And if you believe that, you know, our project is viable, if you believe that we can do it, and we believe we can do it, we have no doubt it can be done. I just need the money through the door. Yes, we are going to apply for lottery heritage funding. Yes, we will look to benefactors as well. We're going to use every available means to get this thing off the air. You know, but the great British public, you've done it once with a Vulcan. If you want to see a mosquito flying, and a British one as well, that you will have in your country, and it will never be sold outside of the UK, come forward.
John, thank you very much for joining us. We wish you all the very success with this project. We want to stay close. We want to continue to support what you're doing. So will you come back and tell us how you're getting on?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. No problem. Well, John, be safe. Thank you very much for your time.
Take care, Peter.
Not a question, but I think it's good to see in the interview that, you know, the amount of progress that's been made, and also getting Winkle on board.
Phenomenal, yeah.
What a coup, you know. So Winkle sort of downplays his achievements in landing a mosquito on an aircraft carrier, but yeah, I mean, you know, great to have him on board as a patron, and it seems to be building up a bit of a head of steam now.
Yeah, seen them at the air shows this year in the UK. Big presence, very professional, project themselves well. Nice bunch of guys. Realise the enormity of the challenge they face, though. But, you know, they're going about it with a vigour that, was it 2 years ago we spoke to Bill originally, Tim, Gareth?
Yes,
two or three years ago. It all seemed very speculative at the time, but they've got their airframe now, even though it's not particularly presentable, and they're off. So good luck to those guys.
Yeah, I don't think if you can find me a person who you think about a mosquito coming back to this country and they just shrug their shoulders, then I probably want to give them a good shake. And I think this is it's an incredible aircraft. And was the precursor, of course, to say, you know, the Cold War bombers and all of those things. So I would, you know, and I'm lucky enough to have seen one first time round, if you know what I mean. Not in the war, obviously, but in the 80s. So it'd be brilliant to see one back. I'm not that old.
Here's a little known fact for some of the geeks out there. You can actually hear a mosquito in the entrance to this program. It's one of the aircraft that we feature in our sounds in our introductory music.
You know what? I didn't even know that.
Ah, there you go. We should have a competition, actually, so you could guess them all.
See if you can name them. Yeah. Roland, one of the most fun things to do, I've found in the last couple of years, is to go into the crew room at the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight at RAF Coningsby when there are both bomber pilots and fighter pilots in there, and pull the pin out of the question of, if the BBMF had a mosquito, who would fly it, a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot? And then step back and watch what ensues.
Watch the fight. Yeah. great.
Yeah, I'm not sure there is a definitive answer to that question, but they'll be fighting over it in due course, hopefully.
Yeah, it'd be whoever wins the fight, won't it?
Brilliant. Well, we've got another interview for you as well. It's one that I carried out with Bill Ramsey, a guy who I've interviewed, I have to say, numerous times now. He's been on Extended before, and I've interviewed him numerous times for Global Aviation Resource as well. And Bill and I had a good catch-up about his season of displaying XH558, and particularly leading the Avro formation with the two Lancasters and flying the Cold War Tour. Here's Bill. Bill Ramsey, welcome back to Extended. Thank you so much for joining us again. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Gareth. Nice to talk to you again.
Well, always a pleasure. You've had a fantastic summer, haven't you? A very, very busy one with that there Avro Vulcan.
Yes, indeed. Indeed we have. It's certainly in the time that I've been involved with the Vulcan, I think it's safe to say it was our most successful, not least because we only lost one display this year, which was due to the weather. We lost nothing at all by the aircraft going tech, which is a fantastic achievement, in particular, of course, for the engineers, by Touchstone and the rest of the engineers.
Just put that into perspective for us, Bill, in terms of keeping her airworthy to that extent. I mean, how much work does it take to ensure that happens?
It's a little like my days with the Red Arrows. It's as much as it takes to make sure the aeroplane, you know, if it's humanly possible for the aeroplane to be ready the next time it flies. Even when there are no major traumas going on, there is plainly routine servicing, and the aeroplane, you know, an elderly aeroplane like that always comes back with some minor problem, which the engineers will then do their level best to fix. I mean, for instance, on and off during the season, We had a problem with a fuel tank indication, which, given that there's 14 fuel tanks, you may not think that's an issue. But actually, the fact that it wasn't working meant that it could mask a real problem in a different part of the system. So it was important to try to fix it. And the engineers worked constantly to get the situation where that was rectified.
Well, it's sterling work, and I know that everybody who enjoys seeing her should pass on has a huge debt of gratitude to those guys. So please pass on thanks, I think, to on behalf of the whole community.
Yeah,
it's been 3 years. That's your third complete season now, isn't it? Of back.
You're losing your count. It's the fourth, actually.
Is it the fourth? Really? Crikey. Crikey, I don't know where the time goes. How do you feel? Does it feel different now, four years down the? Do you feel as if you've sort of? It's a bit like putting on a comfortable pair of slippers or something along those lines.
Yeah, from the point of view of me operating the aeroplane, especially since I last spoke to you now as a captain, I'm considerably more comfortable with what I'm doing. I think we all feel. Yeah, increasingly comfortable just because we've got more hours on the aeroplane recently. This year was interesting because we knew that we were going to try and fly the aeroplane using less engine fatigue, which is one of the critical issues with the Vulcan. And that meant not using full power throughout the displays. So when Kevin and I set off manfully to do the first displays of the year, which were at Welsh Pool and Cosford, knowing that we weren't going to use full power, I think we both had slightly mixed feelings because we thought the public would go, that's really awful. we were quite surprised when it came back and people said, my, they're caning the engines this year. which is when we discovered that actually the Vulcan seems to make a better howl at 90% power than it does at 100%. That had not got, we also had tweaked the display a little bit, so we didn't know how that would go down with the public. It seems to have been well received. But only using 90% for the wingovers means that we've had to tweak the technique that we use for flying those wingovers, because obviously with less power, we don't go up so fast for so long, which meant in the end, we recognized that we should perhaps increase the speed going into the wingovers, which has had the upshot that by the time we flew at Duxford, and your guys have got the photograph of it, It was probably one of the steepest climbs into a wingover that we've done. And it actually, an offshoot of that, it makes it easier to fly the wingover.
How much fun is it, Bill?
Oh, it's still a tremendous amount of fun, but it is. I say it's an interesting challenge trying to match all of the different requirements. Plainly, the first one is public safety. Then it's looking after the aeroplane. Whilst at the same time trying to entertain people within the limits of flying a big old aeroplane. So it's a constant challenge to try to keep tweaking what we do to try to keep it a little bit fresh. Again, this year, because of the modification to leading edge, we've been able to fly the entry into the displays considerably quicker, which is, I think, the arrival flypast has pleased people quite a lot. We've been able to fly the aeroplane because of the CA agreement a little bit closer to the crowd than we have done most of the time in the past. And there's been a little bit more down at 300 feet in terms of fly pass. So hopefully we've managed to tweak it a little bit to everybody's satisfaction.
Well, I certainly think, judging by the feedback I've seen, that would be the case. So yeah, I think fair play for continuing to evolve. That's probably the most important thing. Now, there are a couple of significant events in this summer's calendar that you were specifically involved in. The first one was at the sort of back end of August and involved you leading the formation with the two Avro Lancasters, obviously, namely those from the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight and the Canadian Warplane Heritage Museum. Now, I was very privileged to interview you prior to that, Bill, and you said to me, and I have to confess, reading Global Aviation Resource here, you said, I don't think there's much doubt that this will be my favourite ever day in aviation, or certainly close to it. Is that how it panned out?
Yes, it certainly did. It was well, again, as again with these things that involve the Vulcan and in this case the two Lancaster, it all surprised me just how many, many people took the time out to come and look at it all around the route. So it was very nice. As I told you in the interview, it did take me about 2 weeks of non-stop work to coordinate all the requirements with BBMF, with the Canadians, with the CAA and various other people. So I think I also said in the interview I was slightly daunted by the prospect.
yeah, definitely.
As it turned out, it was a great day. Probably the best part of it was when all three sets of engines actually started up and were able to get to it.
Now, for anyone listening who doesn't know, there's some real personal significance here as well, isn't there? Because you obviously have flown both types, and I think we're right in saying you're the only sort of existing pilot out there who's probably done that, who's flying the Vulcan at the moment.
That's right, the only one of us still flying it. But there are a few other people who are even older than I am who are still alive but retired from flying.
just on that note, did you get a chance this year to watch the two Lancasters with the BBMF?
Well, I was there at what should have been the start, and I was there by accident at the finish, as it turns out. I dutifully stood by Cranwell Airfield in a thunderstorm when they were due to arrive, and you all know the story of how that fell to pieces because of the weather.
Yeah.
And then on the day they departed, which is what, 2 or 3 weeks ago now, I was on my way to the supermarket, funnily enough, and I noticed the gathering of people in where aviation people stand at Cranwell when something's going to happen. So I dutifully climbed out of the car and said, "What's happening?" And they said, "Thumper and Vera and four of the fighters are saying goodbye to Vera." So I watched them depart past Cranwell, which was a magnificent moment.
Fantastic. Secondly, and this again, I just think is fantastic. 25th of September, you took the Vulcan on a Cold War tour, which was an incredible route and taking in some locations of real historical significance. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, it was. I mean, the aim was to visit the 10 V-Force airfields in England anyway. And my brief was not to do a full display, but something a bit more than the flypast at each. So I interpreted that as doing the best bits of the display, or the most dynamic bits of the display at each place. So that's what Kevin and I planned to do. So we ended up doing 10 mini displays at 10 minute intervals over the course of 2 hours, which was we each took turns, in case anyone wonders how we shared out the flying. And it was astonishing, really. I mean, in terms of pure fun, I've never done anything like it. I've never flown an aeroplane where you could go off and fly 10 displays at 10-minute intervals. About halfway around, I turned around, of course, the weather smiled on us. I just looked at Kevin and said, "We're going to get into trouble for this somewhere." even though we weren't breaking any rules, I hasten to say. But again, just amazing how many people turned out on a Thursday to watch the aeroplane. So, but brilliant fun, and of course, as it turned out, it was the last the last trip of the season for us. So it was nice to come back and do a short display at Finningley to say thank you to our own people and to the airport.
The aircraft's now safely tucked up in her hangar back at home, and you were telling me before we started recording that there's some work ongoing ahead of next season. Can you tell us anything about the sort of plans for the winter and looking forward to next year?
As regular followers of the Vulcan will know, that the funding to allow winter servicing to go ahead has been reached, which was overreached actually, so a not insignificant over £200,000. There is a small shortfall in the money to cover the cost of last season, because of course trips like the two you just mentioned, the Lancasters and the Cold War tour, don't of themselves generate income in the way that a normal air show would do. So there were probably heavier costs this summer than in some years. So I'm very hopeful that sum will be reached over the next week or so, and the Trust will have the confidence then to call forward pledges people have made to help finance going forward into 2015. In the meantime, the engineering task goes ahead. We've swapped out one of the engines and brought back one which we had to remove last year to ground run this winter to see if it's one we can use, we could possibly use again next year. So as far as, yeah, we are in the normal sort of place that we find ourselves with the Vulcan at this time of year. That is, you know, teetering on the brink financially, but everything kind of coming together.
And finally, Bill, what does a Vulcan display pilot do during the winter when there's no Vulcan to fly?
Well, it's a good question, actually. I spend a lot of talking to people like you. You know that my involvement with the People's Mosquito, and I believe that actually, I don't know if it was you who conducted, there was an interview with John Lilly on that topic.
Yes, and that will be on this very same episode. So if you're listening to this on Extend, you've either heard that episode, that interview with John Lilly, or you're going to in a little while. I mean, brilliant progress there, we must just say.
Yeah, there's good work there, and I won't steal John's thunder, but I'm sure you'll agree that he's no doubt given me some exciting news regarding that project. So yes, a bit of that. I am a full-time house husband. I have I'm a full-time dad to a Cocker Spaniel who takes up quite a lot of my time, actually. So I don't find that there's too little to do at any one time, I must say.
Fantastic. At least I must just say, I think I've asked you this before, but as we've just mentioned it, let's think. Jet Provost, Hawk, Tornado, Vulcan, Tutor, Mosquito.
I have an uneasy feeling that project will be after my time, unfortunately. However,
Come on, you're not that old.
No, if plainly it's something that I would love to do. And if things moved quickly enough, then that'd be great. But actually, in the case of that project, just the fact that we've got one flying again would be pretty triumphal from my point of view.
Here. Can't disagree with that. Well, we're very diplomatically put. Bill, thank you so much for your time. As ever, a huge pleasure to talk to you. And I've no doubt it'll happen again at some point. But I'm glad you've had a good summer. Thank you very much for bringing the Vulcan to see us and see so many people and entertaining so many people with what is a real significant sort of piece of aviation heritage. So on all fronts, thank you very, very much.
No, thank you. It's nice talking to you again, Gareth.
Thanks, Bill.
Cheers, take care.
What a nice guy. An amazing list of aircraft he's flown. And just when they're mentioned there, it is a gentle reminder of the sort of capabilities he has. For me, though, without doubt, this year has actually been my favourite Vulcan display season. And given all the changes they made, you know, they talked there about the engine settings and the modifications to the leading edges. I don't think that's any mean feat. So I was absolutely delighted to see her. I love seeing Bill fly. Lovely bloke. I suppose the question is, are we definitely going to see XH558 next year?
I think we will next year. And obviously, all things considered, it should be the last chance to see the aircraft. I don't think that's necessarily cast in stone. You know, these changes to the engine settings and the modification that's already been carried out could potentially, I think, and I am being quite speculative here, so please don't hold me to that. I think it could, it could mean an extension to her life. But at the moment, that's just an unknown. And I think I personally would like to see her, want to see her go out on a high. And if they know that it's going to be the end, then let's really enjoy her last season. Hopefully lots and lots of people will get a chance to see her, and that for me is how it should come to a close. Roland, you are inevitably always going to be intrinsically linked with the Vulcan because of the book, but have you had a chance to see her very much this year, or have you just not?
I saw her once this year, and it was wonderful at the Little Grandston air show where both of the Lancasters came over, and then there was a wonderful Vulcan display as well. And I've got a feeling, I mean, rather like you, I'm keen on the idea that she goes out on a high. I think we should know. It'd be nice to know that the final season is the final season, so we can properly sort of drink it in.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that, you know, if that were something that we knew for sure, rather like the two Lancaster tour this year, it would be something which people would make a point of really taking notice of and really trying to make sure they appreciated the experience of that last season. I think could be a wonderful, wonderful way to go out.
I agree. And I think, Tim, there was a lovely point there as well, a sort of broader aviation point that I picked up on from the interview, that, you know, Bill's been a pilot for a long, long time and has had some fantastic experiences, you know, with all these different aircraft. You know, he was wing commander, Red Arrows, etc. But then just this year, he's had his kind of best day in aviation, leading the two Lancasters. And it's kind of lovely from an aviation perspective that it can keep delivering those sort of experiences. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be difficult to top this year. I mean, you know, not only the two Lanks, but also the Cold War base tour that he did. So, but I think it's really what has him sort of struck me this year, you know, with the Lanks is how, particularly how it's reached out and touched people who aren't normally, you know, aviation buffs or interested in aviation or you know, the kind of hardcore av geeks. It's really kind of got a following across the whole of UK. You know, people are kind of obsessively clicking on Plane Finder to see the journey across the Atlantic, and so yeah, I think that you know, hopefully that kind of momentum can be sort of maintained a little bit, and you've got, you know, if there's things like, you know, People's Mosquito comes up, you know, maybe Bill won't be flying that, maybe I don't know, maybe he will, but there's new things to look forward to, you know, and there's always a kind of an anniversary coming up for something. So yeah, let's hope he can continue.
Yeah, too true. So it's a huge thanks to John and to Bill for the time they've given us for those interviews for this episode 33. And we'd love to hear what you think, obviously, as well. So please keep your feedback coming in on the Mosquito and the thoughts that we might get a Mosquito back, and also the 2014 airshow season, particularly, obviously, with XH558. Thanks, guys. We'll take a short break, and then the floor is Tim Robinson's.
Left on the heading 030.
That's 030, call us 976. GoCat 536, do we expect any extended delay?
Pass it on, I'm in the dark as you are at the moment.
Okay, can we hold in a press position?
GoCat 536 here, maintain 9000 if that works, and you can hold him down on the track, make it a 1 minute right hand pattern.
Okay, we'll hold present position, we'll send 9000 right hand 1 minute. Captain's going to have 536.
Velocity 1405, turn left heading 090.
Left heading 090, velocity 1405.
2599, maintain 4000.
2599, descend to 2500.
2500 out of 4000, rescue 599.
There's an approach evening just south 454, and descend 130 Tango.
It's up 454, approach today, runway 32, keep on out, fine.
On air, Mike, 3-2, yes, I've already called.
Inbound, you can commence that when able.
Okay, left-hand, the pattern, 1 minute inbound, Singapore 245. Confirm inbound and re-intercept the localizer again?
Localizer, thanks.
Okay, inbound the localizer and 1 minute left-hand pattern now, Singapore 245.
Left as required to intercept the localizer and hold at 10 miles inbound, 1 minute left-hand pattern, 5000.
Down now, 1-9-7.
Okay, clear to descend to 2100, it's still inside the circling area. Clear to visual approach, tower 1187, rescue 599, thanks, circuit 9.
Right.
Felix 769, Delta, sorry, Saget, heading in for the company.
Heading 020.
Heading 020, left turn, Felix 769, Delta.
245, would you prefer to track out on the heading of 016?
Singapore 245, I just want you to continue in the 1 minute pattern there, holding inbound to the localizer. You can make the inbound clearance limit of 10 miles of Brisbane.
Okay, copy that, Singapore 245. Is it better for us to descend to lower altitude?
Singapore 245, negative, maintain 4000. You'll be number one when we add.
Okay, Singapore 245.
It's about 4640
to 9000, QNH 1015. 9000, 1015,
just 454. Localizer now, turn left heading 020.
Left heading 020, velocity 1405. And have you been updated at this point, just for our further plans?
No, I'm trying to get information, but none forthcoming at the moment. I realise you've got to work out your fuel situation.
Roger that.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome from the Royal Aeronautical Society. The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
A favourite part of Extended, I think. It's X10, it's our top 10. It's Tim Robinson. We don't know what it's going to be. Tim, over to you.
Okay, so for this episode of Extended, we've got quite a topical one for news and for our guest. With the X-37 returning to Earth this week and the 10th anniversary of Spaceship One's historic flight, we take a look at the top 10 space planes.
Hooray!
At number 10, Sanger Orbital Bomber. When was the first space plane designed? Not the 1950s, but proposed 10 years earlier by the Third Reich as a way of hitting America from Europe. Launched down a rocket rail, the Sanger would have skipped off the atmosphere to extend its range for transcontinental bombing missions. Luckily for the Allies, it never got further than a mock-up. At number 9, HOTOL. In an alternative 1980s, British Aerospace, as then was, and Rolls-Royce combined to create a UK reusable space plane and leads the world in cheap orbital access. Sadly, this Ministry of Space vision never occurred, but HOTOL's designer, Alan Bond, has a second space plane, Skylon, now under development. Number 8, Hermes. Cancelled in 1992, Europe's Hermes was a free crew space plane design that would have been launched atop Ariane 5. With hindsight, it seems that now it would be a useful crew transport to the ISS, given the early retirement of the shuttle. Number 7, X-20 Dinosaur. While the US instituted a crash space program based on capsules to catch up with the Soviets, in another alternate timeline, the X-20 space plane won out. Cancelled just as the first vehicle was completed, this concept laid the foundations for the shuttle, X-57, and later space planes. Top factoid, Neil Armstrong was one of the astronauts selected for this project. Number 6, X-30 / NASP. A US 1980s plan to develop a single-staged orbit vehicle, the NASP, National Aerospace Plane, and its X-50 demonstrator ran into technology and funding realities. The concept was for a point-to-point passenger space liner, able to fly from Washington to Tokyo in 2 hours. At number 5, Buran. Moscow's answer to the space shuttle, the Buran orbiter, made only one unmanned flight in 1988, before the Soviet Union imploded and the project was cancelled. Interesting factoid, the initial concept proposed was for orbital nuclear strike bomber, as the Kremlin feared that that's what the shuttle's true mission was. At number 4, Boeing X-37B. Having just landed after almost 2 years in place, the US Air Force's top secret X-37B is a mystery wrapped within an enigma. With more time in space now than the space shuttle, what's this small unmanned spacecraft been doing all this time? At number 3, X-15. Now retired in 1968, the rocket engine North American X-15 still holds the record for manned powered flight, reaching Mach 6.7, a record that still stands in 2014. This test aircraft also flew above 100 kilometres on two of its flights, the official definition of space. At number 2, Spaceship One. It seems like yesterday, but it was just 10 years ago, Scale Composites entered the history books by claiming the X Prize for the first manned spaceflight by a private vehicle. The air-launched suborbital Spaceship One is now being followed by Virgin Galactic Spaceship Two, with space tourism promised just around the corner. And at number one, it has to be the Space Shuttle. It may not have achieved its initial goals for reusability, and two horrific accidents scarred the program, but NASA's space shuttle still remains a monument to aerospace technology, taking off like a rocket and landing like a plane. Highlights of its 135 flights, including building the International Space Station and repairing the Hubble Space Telescope. Well, that's it from me. What do you think, guys? Are they your favourites?
That's just my book. I think you've just done in a nutshell. I'll just put my coat on and go.
Come on then. We'll come to you first, Roland. What's your immediate thoughts? Feel free to disagree. That's the whole point.
Yeah, it's a pretty comprehensive list. The only one that I would I'd add was a kind of a terrific sort of Eagle comic idea that came out of BAC for something called Mustard.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Which was sort of three identically shaped space planes, two of which were boosters. One was supposed to be the manned orbiter, which were sort of launched together. It never made it beyond a sort of paper design and definitely had something in common with some of the sort of US designs as well. I think if you Google Mustard Space Plane, you can find a Wolf Hardy painting of it online with a sort of Union Jack on the wing. So that never happened, but nice to think about in that sort of Ministry of Space kind of a way.
Wow. Peter?
Ooh, good one this, Tim. Good one. Caught me out here. You caught me out. You really did. We had David Ashford, didn't we? The managing director of Bristol Space Planes on the show four or five episodes ago. And of course, they've got the Ascender. I quite like the look of that. I quite liked it. Of course, it's not flown yet, so I don't know whether that's allowed or not in your rules. But unless I fell asleep for all of 2 minutes, what about Reaction Engine Skylon? It's on the front of your magazine, Tim.
It was either that or Hotel. So, successor.
Yeah. I mean, she's just such a monster beauty. She's got to be in there. That's my one, Reaction Engine Skylon.
I've got a question actually for Roland on Space Blades. You know, really the rest of the team as well, is that it's something that is so seductive. Technology, yeah, send it up like a rocket, land like a, but so sort of difficult to actually get right, so many sort of cancelled projects or projects that don't kind of quite make it. Why do you think this is?
It's physics. It's simple physics. It's it's something that, I must admit I didn't know a great deal about until I really started work on this book. But understanding about it's Tsiolkovsky's rocket equation and the difficulties there are with respect to carrying the amount of fuel you need to achieve sort of orbital speed, it all becomes quite clear why so many of these, particularly that the single stage to orbit ideas are, pie in the sky, in that, we just haven't found we just haven't found a fuel that is sufficiently efficient and light to allow space planes to be easier. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. While we're still relying on chemical fuels, space planes are always going to be difficult.
Well, so Gareth, what about you then?
I mean, as Roland said, it's an incredibly comprehensive list. I was wondering whether I could have Thunderbird 3 or not. I'm not sure whether that really counts, to be honest with you. But no, well, I mean, Tim, bloody brilliant. Well done, mate. It's absolutely fantastic. And as ever, please tweet us, Facebook, email. You'll see the address at the end and it'll be on the website. Let us know your thoughts. But very, very strong work, Mr. Robinson. Very impressive. Well done.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Hashtag that X10 top 10 and we'll pick that up.
Singapore 245, I appreciate you came from the Gold Coast, but would that be your alternate if required, if we don't resolve the situation, and if you could advise what your divert time would be in due course?
Singapore 245, we can hang around for about 5
security breach onto the runway by persons. One has been detained, however, they're still looking for the others. The Australian Federal Police have closed the Brisbane Airport until further notice. Any further updates, I'll pass on this frequency. All stations considering their alternates. There are quite a few aircraft also not on this frequency who are considering the Gold Coast as an alternate. You want to take that into account for your diversion times.
Frosty 14.05 requesting divert to the Gold Coast.
Frosty 14.05, maintain present heading positioning for Gold Coast and duty runway there is runway 32.
Frosty 14.05, maintain present heading and we're requesting the RNAV team divert runway 32.
Frosty 14.05, 15 to 5,000 Gold Coast QNH 1015, copy the request on the approach.
10-5,000, QNH 1015, Lofty 14.05. And GoCo 5-6, Limited, do we sort of really need a decision here? Do you feel it will be resolved in the next 10 minutes or not?
So we have an estimate that the Federal Police will update us in 10 minutes, 10 minutes, but that's not necessarily going to be a positive update.
GoCo 5-6, we'd like diversion to the Gold Coast.
Velocity 14.05, connect approach 1235 with the heading.
Say again, Velocity 14.05.
Velocity 14.05, approach 1235 now, today.
1235, Velocity 14.05.
GoCat 536, for the sequence into the Gold Coast, turn left now onto heading of 090, descend to 7000.
090, descend 7000, GoCat 536.
936 found at Silo Approach.
Frosty 14.05. Frosty 14.05 requesting that approach via Gold Coast Sierra Alpha.
Frosty 14.05, take that.
Hi, this is Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Each week we bring you Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment covering European aviation. Check us out at airplanegeeks.com. Until then, enjoy extended.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Fantastic. So, speaking of feedback, that's where we're going to go next. And there's plenty of it. Not all of which I think we're going to get a chance to read out in full, but I am going to dive headlong into a few bits and pieces. Isaac Alexander was introduced to the Africa Defence Podcast through listening to our last episode, so that's good news, and he enjoys the show that we produce. Thank you very, very much. Joseph Chung emailed to say about the worst aircraft section.
Yeah, this is not going in a good direction, is it?
No, DC-10 was obviously in there, much to Peter's disappointment. And he said he doesn't want to say it's the worst, but he did have a bad experience throwing up on one. So I think he may be tempted to include it on there as well, just for the memories of the air sickness. Yeah. Dave Holmes has been in touch. We've got the latest Wings Over New Zealand podcast is online as well. There's some great stuff on there, no matter where you're based, but some UK content on there as well. So
can I just jump in there, Gareth?
Of course you can.
I, if you like stories and you like stories of people's career, Jonathan Pote's a Brit who now lives in New Zealand, but it's a great story. He's got some great anecdotes. Really enjoyed listening to it. Very easy to listen to. So we'll put a link to that in our show notes.
Yeah, no question at all. Just reading through the notes here, there's some fascinating stuff in there, isn't there? Absolutely.
Yeah, some
brilliant.
Hilarious stories as well, and some sort of black humour, should we say.
Yeah, definitely. Neil Braden's been in touch. He's moved to Ireland from the US, so he admits that he's fallen behind listening to Extended a little bit. Slap wrist, Neil, but he does say that he's beginning to catch up, and he enjoyed listening to our reminiscences about flight sims. Roland, we had the editor of PC Pilot, the flight sim magazine, on last time out. Have you ever delved into the world of flight simulation?
I've got to confess, I haven't really. I've tried it a little bit a long time ago on BBC microcomputers. I mean, I know that the sort of technology has kind of come on, one would hope, extraordinarily, you know, since I was mucking about BBC microcomputers. But it's been something that's kind of escaped me, I must admit. Although I've certainly seen some of the snippets that people have put together on YouTube. I think sometimes directed there by you, Tim. And it is. It's remarkable.
You posted one today, actually, I think, Tim, which was remarkable.
That was,
Rise of Flight, was it?
Yeah, I mean, like we said the other week, you know, if you plan to get into flight sims, they've improved a lot since the 1980s, and the the fidelity, not only the graphics but the flight modeling is really kind of quite amazing, you know. It's bridging the gap between, you know, the professional level stuff and home simulation.
And Neil goes on to say, he talks about some of the Dovetail game situation with the FSX engine that we talked about, and also recommends everyone goes out and buys a new next generation Intel processor, hint hint, which I'm guessing is a connection to where Neil works. Probably. He's equally very glad that everyone enjoyed the two Lancasters, and makes the point, Tim, as you did, that he had a lot of non-aviation friends at work mentioning how great it was seeing them fly together. So that's fantastic. Neil, thank you as ever for getting in touch. In terms of the X10 top 10 flight sims, this will be Tim's ears will be pricking up here to see what people thought. At Falcon124 on Twitter said he got many hours flying Falcon 3 and Red Baron, but also F-15 Strike Eagle, X-Plane, various Microsoft flight simulators, and also a Hello Sim with an Osprey in. He said if price was no option, he would have two or more F-18 Hornet simulators with dome visuals, which would be networked together. So, you know, price and space, potentially, I would suggest. You're going to need quite a lot of room to do that. Neil Braden is also lucky enough to fly the F-16 simulator at Luke Air Force Base. Mehdi Azera said Jane's Fighter Anthology 97. Said it was more than a game, than a sim, but it was a great source of video and aircraft specs when YouTube and Wikipedia exception weren't around. That he reckons that was sort of late 90s probably. Pod's challenge, we got Amy asked us which aircraft we would like to see flying low level through the Mach loop and why. Just a note on Amy, she has a new Twitter handle, which is at Amy E Parkin, which we will put on in the show notes. Thanks for that, Amy. At ATC underscore Ben said he'd like to see Royal Australian Air Force F-111, F-18, honourable mentions C-17, KC-30, E-7P-8, BBJ, and 757. 757 would look quite nice going low level, wouldn't it? F-14 from Craig Moulding, Mark at Raleigh Mark, Airbus A380, Kev Wyatt, and English Electric Lightning, which he describes as being a pilot strapped to two jet engines, which isn't too far off. Michael Edney, it's at Michael Edney, would like to see a squadron of TSR-2s. and says what a sight that would be. Not going to argue with that. Graham Wilson, at Wilson Graham S. Harrier JR9, because it would mean the idiots in government hadn't scrapped them. Gareth Moore went for C-17. We have MiG-29. Vulcan from Joe Ayres. Mehdi Azdara, F-4 Phantoms. He said, why does love need a reason? Which I thought was quite nice. So thank you very much for all of that feedback. It's great to hear that you're all listening. It's great to see some new names there as well. We love the fact that we've got people who have been kind of listening since the word go, but equally it's brilliant to hear that we've got new listeners. And if you know somebody who's interested in all this kind of stuff and they haven't listened to us, why not give them a shove in our direction and see what they think of Extended, and we'd love to hear what they do think. Now, we must just mention Dragons of Thin Air, which we do every month, every episode. We give away a copy of Doug Worrell's book, and it's a fantastic book designed to help anybody who's afraid of flying. And one in four people are actually afraid of flying. If you're interested in getting a copy of the book, and it is a great volume, send Peter a DM, either to himself or to the Extended Twitter account, and we'll send a copy on to you and give you a mention in the show. And as ever, thank you very, very much to Doug Worrell for kindly providing the books for you. And when we're gone, or if you don't get one, have a look on Amazon. There's a link on our website, and go and have a look at Dragons of Thin Air.
Back otherwise, that continues the Gold Coast.
Cross 977, that's understood, sir. Turn left, heading 150, positioning just to a midpoint position to beam Jake as well.
Left heading 150, corner 977.
Back at 536, contact approach on 123.5.
Approach 123.5, go cat 536.
Cross 34 to enter a 5, through Shimano navigation track to Charlie Golf, here at Alpha for the Arno Silu, runway 32.
Brisbane approach, go cat 536, heading 090 degrees, descending to 7000.
Second 536, Brisbane approach, today runway 32 to the Gold Coast. You prefer the Arnav Silu?
Go cat 536, A turn.
Second 536, Arnav Silu to runway 32.
Arnav Silu, runway 32, go cat 536.
Second 536, turn right, heading 130, vectors towards downwind. At this stage, you've got around about 50 miles to run. When ready, descend at 6,000.
Right turn 130, when ready, descend 6,000, go cat 536.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
One of our regular segments, it's time for Pod's Challenge.
Hi, Pete, Gareth and Tim, and everybody listening to this episode of Extended. I have a new Pod's Challenge for everyone, but it's not really a challenge. I recently noticed on the Dutch F-16 demo page that they may or may not be coming back with a new display scheme next year. So I was wondering what are your thoughts on this. Personally, I'd really love to see another scheme on their aircraft. Obviously, you all know that's my favourite team. So yeah, I'm quite looking forward to seeing what they might come out with next year. And what would you like to see mostly? I'd quite like to see the orange again. Even if it's the same as last time, I'd be happy. So yeah, what are your thoughts on this? And I'll see you all in the next episode. Bye guys.
Well, listen, I know that the Dutch F-16 is a huge favourite of Amy's in an air show sense. The orange lion has gone. The team used a standard, normally squadron grey painted aircraft this year. I would love to see a new scheme come back. The line had been around for a long time. It was fantastic, but we had seen it for a long time. It's got to be orange, hasn't it? Because this is Holland we're talking, you know, the Netherlands we're talking about. Yeah. But you know what? They are, you know, they're off in theatre doing various things. Money's short, time is tight. I've got to say, and I am going to play devil's advocate here, I just think the most important thing is that it'd be really nice to see the F-16, the Dutch F-16, continue to visit the UK as often as it does. If they've got a coloured aircraft, great. If they haven't, brilliant. Still, thanks for coming.
I agree, actually. Sometimes we get carried away with the paint schemes and logos and things like that. And if I'm absolutely honest, sometimes when these guys are displaying it, you can't really make out too much of the paint scheme anyway. They're throwing these things around in the sky so much that, you know, who really cares? But as you said, love to see it in an orange scheme, love to see it in any scheme, but let's just get it here first and foremost. And I think that that's the biggest challenge. As you said, the Dutch Air Force is under significant pressure, and let's just all keep our fingers crossed to hopefully see it next year and in an orange scheme if they can.
Tim?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd like to echo those thoughts. I mean, they did also, has to be remembered, they did have that attractive orange and grey scheme on the orange, grey and black scheme on the Apache as well, which
yep.
was which was pretty. I mean, I've never seen another Apache sort of done up like that. So
yeah,
I think it would be, you know, if they can come here and display an F-16, that would be brilliant. You know, if it's a different exciting scheme on top of that, that's just icing on the cake. As we've recognised, that they're pretty busy at the moment, and there's not much cash to go around.
Where does Roland White stand on special schemes on aircraft, I wonder?
Well, it's funny. I suppose my kind of reaction to them has sort of moved on. I always sort of felt that the incredibly colourful US Navy schemes that you sort of saw throughout the 70s, somehow at the time, I sort of wasn't that keen on them, and now kind of the more colourful and sort of unusual things look, I suppose just because we're so used to a sea of grey everywhere, yeah, the more interested I am. I mean, you know, what I'd give to see kind of anything in the RAF covered in sort of green and grey camouflage now, when at the time, I took it all for granted. All for a little bit of variation in a world where, you know, kind of every airliner is white with a red stripe or blue stripe or a green stripe down the side, and every military aircraft, whether it's a helicopter, maritime patrol aircraft, a fighter, bomber, tanker or transport, is grey.
Yeah, I can't, it's difficult to argue with that, I think. But
there's an interesting thing with that is that the original sort of obviously reason for painting everything grey was obviously camouflage. It works better as camouflage in all light conditions, you know, air superiority grey. But I think, you know, given the lack of air-to-air combat over the past, 10, 20 years, the reason now has kind of morphed into, it's one of cost, you know.
Yeah.
One colour, one base colour, and you're away and you're done, you know, a bit of stenciling. And it's now based around keeping costs down.
That said, the news doesn't seem to have reached Germany.
That's very true. That's very true.
There are some wonderful. I mean, I know that the stories in Germany are that the Air Force no longer capable of deploying, but there are some very colourful schemes that come out of Germany. Most notably, that Tiger Strike Typhoon or Eurofighter, which looks spectacular.
Yeah, the Bavarian Tiger.
Mm.
Hey ho, bring back bare metal. That's what I say. Surely that's the cheapest way doing it, anyway.
Yeah, that's
bare
that
carbon
would be great.
These days, I suppose. But brilliant, Amy. Thank you so much, and we look forward to the next one. And as ever, we look forward to hearing what you think. Do we have an orange F-16 or something different or a normal, like, you know, normal jet off the line? Tell us what you think, and I know that Amy will look at that with interest too. Okay, we're nearly done.
Hi, I'm Mick Oakey. I'm the managing editor of The Aviation Historian, and I'm listening to Extended.
Promoting aerospace, and it's time to make your final nominations for our awards. Now, we've not had many airports and airfields nominated, and as Peter's pointed out to me, we know that some of you guys have got quite strong views on that, so do let us know. We also want to hear what you think what the best current restoration project is. Blogs, websites, if you've got one, you can nominate yourself as to fit into the best online resource category. Obviously, it's totally free to nominate, and it's great publicity for you if you win. We've got some other categories, so we're going to keep this open for you guys, and then I think we're going to chew the fat, see what you've nominated, see what we think, and come up with our list of winners at the end of the year. But Best Aerospace Watch, Best Product Helping the Aviation Aerospace Industry, Best Airport, Best Airfield, as I said, Best Online Resource, Best Restoration Product, and then we're going to have an overall extended Best Aerospace Product as well. Make your nominations, drop us an email, and please do drop us an email to x10d@mail.com. Yeah, we really want to hear from you. We get some brilliant feedback from you every month. So just take a few minutes, if you can, to have a think about these categories. And we'll put them all in the show notes as well. And tell us who you are and why you've nominated whatever it is you want to nominate. So, yes, please do that. And you've got until the 1st of November. Whew. Right. That was quite epic, wasn't it? We are almost at the end. We need to thank White Hearts for the use of their music, Live ATC and Peter Dixon for the contributions, and as ever, Doug Worrell and Basic Six for their support. Thanks again to Amy for another POS challenge, and John and Bill for their interviews. You're mainly going to find us on Facebook and Twitter. You can always look us up as Aviation Extended. Don't forget there's no E on Extended, and all the details are on the website as well, along with our legal policy and use of our material can be found on there as well. Just ask us before using anything you hear. Where can we find everybody online? Roland, as well as saying thank you, if anybody ridiculously isn't following you already, how do they find you?
Well, thanks again for having me on the show. It's the Twitter handle is at Roland White, and it's Roland with a W, so R-O-W-L-A-N-D White, as in colour. And the website is rolandwhite.com, so both straightforward.
Fantastic. Thank you very much once again. Best of luck with all of those projects. And I think it probably goes without saying that we look forward to welcoming you back onto a future episode to hear how everything's going.
Thank you. I shall look forward to it. It's always a real pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks again, Roland. Peter Johnson, whereabouts are you online?
Oh, you can find me mainly under the name of Nascot Hornet, or you can find me at XTP Media. I'm almost on LinkedIn, always keen to connect up with people, so you can find me on there as well.
And Mr. Robinson?
Yep, I'm at RES Tim R on Twitter, and the website you want to navigate yourself to is www.aerosociety.com.
And in true to Ronnie's fashion, it's good night from me as well. I'm Gareth _Stringer, or www.globalaviationresource.com. Thank you for listening in. Tell us what you thought about it. And remember, stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Yep, good stuff.
Yep.
Good luck. Oh my goodness. I didn't mean it to quite sound like that.
Yeah.
Don't screw up.
Yeah, it sounds like you're setting yourselves up for disaster.
You'll go stand behind me over there, and I'll just stand out here on my own.
Brilliant. Right, I'm just going to put my blanket over my head. The things I do for podcasting.
Did you make yourself a little den? Do you want to hear something really funny? I know that you're probably, I'm going to say this now, that you're probably stitching up and include this as an outtake. I'm sat here, right, in my little...
Hang on, let me start the recorder.
the little Gar HQ. I've got my own version of the script up on one screen. I've got Skype and my record on the other. I've got my notepad in case I need it, which has got a pen and a pencil, right? And yeah. I come upstairs, I've got my drink to the other side.
Yep.
And I'm all ready to host episode 33 of this hugely successful thing. And I've got my headphones on. And I'm thinking, that's a bit funny. It doesn't seem to be working properly. All right. Maybe I should plug the headphones in.
Maybe that's a tip for our listeners at the end of the show. You know, if you find the quality of extended not up to your usual standards, try plugging your headphones in.
But that I've looked at that, and by the way, hang on a sec. Does anyone know where Roland is? you'd think we'd know that how to do this by now.
Episode 33.
And they're too busy. They're a bit busy at the moment, sort of bombing people.
Okay. Oh. Oh dear.
Hello.
Hi, Roland.
Hi. I'm really sorry. I'm sort of surrounded by devices, all of which I'm trying to get to work.
There's something all around, like, you know, Saturday swap shop in the 80s.
Believe you me, this is not the first instance of technological difficulties getting in the way of extended.
Yeah. Sort of starts giving me the willies now. Sort of imagine that you're going to get the sort of the police around any second.
I do feel like we should be congratulating you on your single reaching number one in the UK top 40 or something like that. I believe Tim's autobiography is coming out for next Christmas, funnily enough, but it's not been, not been confirmed.
You're going up against Michael McIntyre and Lee Evans.
That's what we said, but he's quite good.
Well done.
That's a wrap.
Yeah.
Oh.
Snip a few wires, bugger off.
I'll just put my coat on and go.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.